1694. That's actually a number. It's a Skype subscription number. You can leave a message and I'll definitely get back to you. 347-480-1694. If you have any thoughts, I'm going to put on some music in preparation for transition. Macy Gray, A Moment to Myself. And I suppose I could take your call off the air at 212-209-2900. Take care.
I saw a rainbow just earlier today. Lately those rainbows be coming round like every day. Deep in the struggle, I have found the beauty of me. God is watching and the devil finally let me be.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and enchantment. I am Jim Freund. With me, Dan Persons. Yes, it's a media morning. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I've got a bit of a problem here. I try as much as possible to avoid spoilers, even though research more and more proves that people actually appreciate them. I prefer to err on the side of caution, nevertheless. But in the case of the new film Predestination, given what I presume is the prime demo for Hour of the Wolf, as soon as I mention the film's source material, I will automatically have given away a major bit of the film's plot. It can't be avoided, though, so for those of you well-versed in SF literature, let me just apologize in advance. Predestination is an adaptation of Robert Heinlein's All You Zombies. Plot spoiled? You're welcome. In it, a writer of true confession stories spills his tale of woe to a sympathetic bartender. It's not the typical sob story, though, since the writer, a male, started life as a female, eventually destined for a promising career in Space Corp, an organization that recruits patriotic party girls to service astronauts in orbit. That was until she was seduced and impregnated, and in the course of giving birth, discovers she actually carries an additional set of male organs, which the doctors are forced to activate during her cesarean. The bartender, for his part, is actually a time traveler who offers to bring the writer face to face with the man who ruined her/his life in exchange for the writer joining his organization of crime-fighting time cops. That's probably where I should cut off the synopsis, so I'm going to do just that. I'll say this right off. The biggest flaw of Predestination is probably the thing that the directors Michael and Peter Spierig, a.k.a. the Spierig brothers, who also co-wrote, had to add in order to get the film made. While the film remains largely faithful, and surprisingly so to Heinlein's story, a new plotline has been added in the form of a mad bomber that the temporal police are chasing through time. It gives the film a ticking clock aspect missing from the original tale, and on the plus side, it fills in a notable gap in the original story. Heinlein introduces us to the time cops, but doesn't really elaborate on what they do. But as much as the Spierigs try to work this new element into the original convoluted plotline, it doesn't quite pan out, to the point where the bartender's temporal police boss shows up to chide him for tampering too severely with the timeline, kind of the way a surrogate Heinlein might call out the directors for messing with his plot. Thing is, though, that a lot of the elaborations the Spierigs add are well thought out and gracefully executed. While All You Zombies is a story that toys with some very clever ideas, there isn't much to it to grab onto emotionally, and the directors have managed to remedy that lack. Granted, once you understand the full dimensions of the plotline and have some time to reflect on things, the emotional component can be a bit creepy. But in the telling, it's well done and welcome, and the leads, Ethan Hawke as the barkeep, Sarah Snook as the writer, have an undeniable chemistry. One can also question the Spierig's decision to include the Space Corp angle. The story was written in 1958, looking forward to a future set around the 1970s. But given that the film now looks back to the same time, the notion of government-backed orbiting call girls, whether or not they're tricked out as mid-60s stewardesses, adds an alt-history element that doesn't quite play with the rest of the story. But at least by that conclusion, the Spierigs demonstrate that they recognize the value of the original story. And all in all, their respect is paid off in the rare adaptation whose digressions actually add to the experience. I'm not sure why Predestination is being snuck into exactly one theater in New York in a token release. Anybody who loves science fiction will think that it deserves better. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Well, I couldn't get my music quite up in time, so I'm going to stall for just a minute. Ah, here it comes, a red line slowly going. But we're going to, Dan Persons has his top 10 genre list of movies for last year. We'll also try to take out a little bit of time for television and other media. But now I find, you know, the computer has finally given me access to my music. And so imagine that we're still hearing that .com at the end. And
I can do it again for you.
Okay, well, hold on. Your mic is on.
Okay.
Tell
me when I can pick it up again.
Hold on. There we are. Let me close B, close mode on Deputy Dan. Okay, there. So
Deputy Dan has no friends.
That's right. That's right. And then there's
obscure reference.
Well, but a Pacifica radio reference.
Yes, that's true.
Because they never did Deputy Dan Has No Friends on Bozos.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is where Deputy Dan actually is a going character. He's just sort of a poem,
right,
a zen-like poem on dear friends from KPFA.
Yeah.
Was it KPFA or KPFK?
I do not know.
David Osmond
on
is from WBAI.
On Dear Friends, it was a children's book that was being...
Right.
That was being translated. Apparently a children's book originally in Spanish.
Yes.
That was being translated.
That's right. That's right. But people should get the originals. You know, that album, Dear Friends, is nothing but a best of compilation of something like 50, 60 hours of their radio show from Pacifica Radio.
Is that available?
Yes. At the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Ah.
PRA. Just Google up Pacifica Radio Archives, and they will sell it to you.
Hmm.
And tell them Jim is... Actually, I think you can actually do that. Yeah. Say, I went there because of Hour of the Wolf, and that will, you know, give me brownie points.
I learned...
No money, just brownie points.
I learned a lot about comedy, weirdly, just listening to Dear Friends, the compilation. I learned about yes and before I even knew there was a term, yes and.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Farsine Theater to this day is the best modern science fiction radio drama produced on this side of the pond.
Yeah.
On the other side of the pond, it's, of course, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And by that, I mean the original. And I like to remind people, it was not originally a book. It was a radio drama and was first broadcast ever in the United States on Hour of the Wolf.
Almost everything they did, Nick Danger, Third Eye. I think we're all bozos on this bus.
Yeah.
That was all science fiction.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why they were nominated for the Hugo Award.
Yeah.
They were nominated for Don't Crush a Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, and they lost to some piece of whatever called 2001, A Space Odyssey.
The fools.
And then I think We're All Bozos on This Bus was nominated for a Hugo and lost to the same guy who turned out some POS called Clockwork Orange. I mean...
Can you imagine?
You know, and just in order to block the Firesign Theater, I really don't know why they don't give the Firesign Theater a special award, because if you take side... 2 of their first album, Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him.
Yeah.
Side 2 of, what's the name of the others, side of Nick Danger? With Temporarily Humbled Country.
Yeah, right, yeah.
All that.
Well, that was the first album.
That's
the first album.
That's on Electrician.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the other side of it.
Yeah.
So what's the flip side of Nick Danger?
Flip side of Nick Danger, I think, is Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him.
That's it.
Yes.
No, that's the first album.
Wait a minute.
Okay. No, you're right. You're right.
Yes. Yeah.
God,
yeah,
how could I forget my fire sign? I used to be rated on how many mistakes I would make when reciting Nick Danger. I went into a booth, and another volunteer went into another booth at our 39th Street studios, and we each recorded all the voices for Nick Danger, and then were rated with the script by some people working with Paul Gorman and other aficionados of fire sign, and I lost by about 5 mistakes for the entire album. So, you know, for me to not remember the whole sequence, and then all of Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Potters, and all of Bozos, and if you take, you know, one side of one album, one side of the second album, and then both sides of the subsequent two albums, which even on MP3 downloads are broken up into their component sides, you have one continuing radio drama, an entire arc that begins and ends with this whole George Tirebiter story.
Yeah.
And it's masterful. It really is. Not to mention, even though it was done in the late 60s, early 70s, the understanding of radio and radio production values, the power of radio drama.
They were groundbreakers.
They really were. And people today, you kids today, you just don't know. You just don't know the Fire Sign Theater.
You and your Miley Cyrus.
Yes. There really aren't comics of that.
No, water. No. There isn't an audio comedy troupe.
With all the podcasts out there.
Yeah.
You know, there are some.
Well, you know what? No, I tell a lie. If we're talking podcasts, then...
Audio drama.
There are things like, and I haven't heard them, but I believe Professor Blastoff is one. There's a... it's not really like one long sketch per show, but there's a regular show called Super Ego.
I've vaguely heard of that, but it's still not Fire Sign Theater.
It's
and
not
even
quite
Fire
the
Sign
same.
Theater. Although Super in its later years,
Super Ego gets, I think, into some very effective and impressionistic uses of sound. So Super Ego gets in some ways.
Yeah, and there are some people that have done. I'll tell you who does good radio drama, and that's ZBS. ZBS out, I forget where they're out of. I think it's upstate New York or something like that. But who produce Ruby Intergalactic Gumshoe, which of course features the Android Sisters. And the Android Sisters alone, they're the commercials mostly.
Yeah.
But I should say the non-commercials.
Let me correct something, because it's 1:30 and my brain is fading. But I believe Professor Blastoff is actually more one of the standard type of podcasts, basically an interview with a comedian heading it up. I think the thing I'm thinking of is called Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Okay. A more promising title.
Yeah, and also Frank Conniff, a.k.a. TV's Frank from MST3K.
Oh, wow.
Occasionally does audio musicals.
I have a lot of respect for those, for both generations of the MST3K. Yeah. Although, you know, puppets on radio, we need more puppets on radio. Joel Hodgson, do you hear me? We need more puppets on radio.
Worked for Edgar Bergen.
It certainly did. Yeah. And you couldn't tell on the radio that his lips moved. That was the old joke. They ran that joke for years. And you watch the amazing thing is you watch the old movies with him and Charlie and Mortimer and all that. And he doesn't even try to throw his voice. His lips totally move.
Yeah.
And you know what? He is so good with his characters and with his puppetry that nobody notices and nobody cares. They bought it.
There's an old joke, and this probably isn't accurate, but it was Edgar Bergen was doing an act somewhere like in Vegas or something, and he was taking his bows, And while he's taking his bows, there's a woman up front who goes, Paul Winchell's lips don't move. And Edgar Bergen, apparently without moving his lips, goes, Paul Winchell doesn't make $5,000 a night.
Well, I would suspect that story is apocryphal.
Yeah.
But
fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Charlie McCarthy couldn't do the Nestle jingle.
So. Yeah.
There. So, you know, I'm almost wondering if it's even worth it. I've got the song queued up. We can use it later, or we can play it now.
Let's play it now.
Okay,
since it's somewhat...
So you do the...
You want me to cue
outro,
you again?
Yeah, cue me.
Okay. So, catch up on what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
This next song was inspired by a massive hangover and the Jerry Springer Show. I woke up in a hotel room one time after having a really fun night on stage. My head hurt, my belly hurt, my hand hurt, my voice hurt, and everything else as well. I didn't know what time it was, I didn't know what state I was in, didn't know what city I was in. So what I did in a hotel room, as you do when you're on tour, is you put on the TV and you look for CNN and you start flicking through the stations looking for CNN because they have a little clock in the bottom right-hand corner. So I'm surfing through the channels. I found the Jerry Springer Show and I thought, okay, light a cigarette, pick up the bottle of Jameson I was drinking earlier and give it 10 minutes only. There's two kids on there. He was 23. She was 19. They had been married. Had two beautiful children. Got divorced. She remarried to his father and had another child. And I'm sitting there with a hangover in probably one of the most beautiful cities in all of America. A place called Detroit. And I'm trying to figure out how the children are related to each other. This is what I came up with. It's a song of a...
All that build-up and the internet signal freezes. I mean, come on.
I knew we should have gone with All You Zombies.
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay, let me pause it. Maybe he'll finally start the damn song. I wish I could have found the original country version,
yeah,
but...
Yeah, which, by the way, plays during the movie.
Oh, good. Well, it has to. I mean, it's critical to the story.
It doesn't have to. What I find interesting, as I noted in the review, is how faithful they actually are to the story, although the tone... is dramatically different from the tone of the story.
Hmm. Yeah. And regular listeners, old-time listeners to Hour of the Wolf should be very familiar. We've performed All You Zombies on this program many times over the years. Well, I am stymied here.
Okay,
the volume is up. It looks like it's playing. Have we lost our stream? I wouldn't put past... Okay, it's... All the little doodad things are moving.
I'd sing it for you, but I only know the one line.
Yeah, I'm my own grandpa, yeah, but... In case people couldn't figure out after all that talking what we were...
You could try reaching Floyd Vivino. He's probably looking for work now. He could probably sing it over the phone to us.
Well, we might get down to that. I'm just curious. What if I chose a different song? Will that... It was just that song.
Huh.
It was just that song. So it was the stream that somehow... cut out.
Wonderful.
Let me start it again and start it in the middle and see if it's the same thing. And yet the little VU meter there shows that it's playing something.
It's playing,
but another song. This is like what my life has been like over the last 2 weeks. All technologies have just been...
Your lips are moving. Out. I cannot hear.
Yeah, well, and what?
But it really is so.
Ah, there we go.
I'm my own grandpa. My baby boy, he then became a brother-in-law to Dad. So he was my uncle, and that made me very sad. 'Cause if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother of the widow's grown-up daughter, who of course is my stepmother. My father's wife then had a son who kept him on the run. So he was my grandchild, 'cause he was my daughter's son. The wife is now my mother's mother, and it makes me blue. Because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. I'm my own grandpa. Let's hear you singing. I'm my own grandpa. Sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. I'm my own grandpa. If my wife is my grandmother, then I'm her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild. For now I have become the strangest case you ever saw. As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. On your own.
I'm my own grandpa.
Sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. I'm my own grandpa.
Thank you very much indeed.
Boy, that was a trip getting there, but
well,
at least people got a taste of it. Yeah.
We should have gone with All You Zombies.
But the song has nothing
to do. Yeah, it has nothing to do. I get the feeling like they were on the road somewhere and one of the roadies had a science fiction magazine.
It's like
laid open.
Doing a song, Starship Troopers flying high above.
Yeah.
And again, it's got nothing to do with Heinlein or Leon Russell. All these are Heinlein things.
Right.
Leon Russell doing the song Stranger in a Strange Land.
Yeah.
And has nothing. I don't think that Leon Russell would have been able in those days to look at the words without them flying off the page and doing little acrobatic kind of things. One gets that impression watching him, especially when he was performing with the now late Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
But Stranger in a Strange Land was on a Leon Russell solo album.
Yeah, yeah. Because titles are not copyrightable.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. But you figure if you're doing an homage,
In the case of the Hooters, they weren't. I'm not sure what they were doing.
There's a lousy song called "Hour of the Wolf." More than one, I think.
Yeah.
See the movie, everybody. See the movie. That's the original.
Hour
of the Wolf.
Oh, Hour of the Wolf. Yeah, okay.
Have you ever seen that?
No, I have not seen it.
It's
Bergman.
Genre.
Bergman.
It's Bergman. Bergman. It's genre.
Yeah.
I mean, if werewolves and vampires...
I saw Cry of the Wolf, the satire they did on SCTV.
I vaguely remember that one. I mean, the ultimate Bergman rip.
Yeah.
Is the one with Madeline Kahn. I think it's called The Dove.
Oh, I don't think... Was Madeline Kahn in that? I remember
I
The Dove.
I believe Madeline Kahn is that. It's like, yeah.
Was she in that?
Oh, yes.
Very early in her career.
Yes. Yeah, very early in her
career.
I think, in fact, before the real launch of her career. Unless I'm mistaken.
I remember the end of the film. It's a short film, by the way. I remember the end of
the
film.
It's about 6 minutes.
Yeah, with the dove
pooping on Death's robe and
yes.
Death going off and going, I just got this geflintet schmatte gewascht.
Yes, exactly, yes. Exactly.
All done in double talk Swedish.
In double talk Swedish, yes. And by the way, it has been pointed out to me properly that the real name of this radio program is Vargtimen.
Well, that's good to know.
It is good to know, because that's the name of the movie.
It's
this radio show is named after that movie.
Movie.
Therefore, the name of this radio show, by all rights, is Vargtimen.
Vargtimen. And that's Hour of the Wolf?
Wolf Hour.
Wolf Hour.
Varg. Just like Varg. Tolkien uses wargs, right?
Right.
Vargtimen.
Timen.
Time. And it is that, and it refers to the morning twilight.
Mm-hmm.
When, I could play the whole, I can play the radio trailer for the movie and it explains Bergman's entire thing. But it's the hour when magical things can happen and your dreams become real.
Right.
It's the hour that people die and when children are born. And when you think, well, wait a minute, you know, that means that the Hour of the Wolf is about 3 minutes long. Not in Sweden. In Sweden, that would be about the morning twilight. It's about 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a long time. And that the movie plays on that a great deal.
Of course, these days, if you call it Wolf Time, people are going to be tuning in going, where's Wolf Blitzer?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so
exactly.
You don't want to do that.
No, we don't want to do that. But and by the way, again, I always have to point out J. Michael Straczynski had it wrong. In season 4, episode 1 of Babylon 5, the name of the episode is Hour of the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
He has, what's her name, Claudia Christian, ruminating on what Hour of the Wolf is, and she said, oh, it's that time at 3 a.m. when you're by yourself and all these things come to haunt you. Wrong.
Well,
sorry.
It worked for the show.
It just not only works for this show, Bergman didn't make it up. This isn't a Bergman thing. It's a Swedish thing. It's a Scandinavian thing overall. And one time when I had Veronica Shaness on this show, and she teaches this stuff, at Queen's College. She teaches myth and legend and lore and all that. And I was talking about it once. She said, oh, Vargtimen. Yeah, of course. and she explained exactly what it was. She's never heard of the movie. She had no... She just knew what the Hour of the Wolf is. And it is that the same legend that Bergman was pulling on for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And since the radio show began at 5 a.m., ended at 7, somewhere the Hour of the Wolf in New York City always occurred, even though it's a lot shorter than the Swedish one.
Right.
So therefore the title.
Yeah, it's always Hour of the Wolf somewhere.
Yeah, well... Well, given how long it is...
Oh, give me something.
Beginning of Act 2 of Little Night Music. they're standing there and going, 8 o'clock... Twilight. 9 o'clock, twilight. 10 o'clock, twilight.
Yes.
It's the beginning of Act 2. Anyway.
So.
I took Dan to task as promised off air.
Yeah,
the woods.
Let's get clear on this.
Because from what
I understand, you want to call me out because I had the temerity to merely like the film.
No, because I think you misinterpreted things in the film.
Namely,
Jack's song, for example. Because you actually were making fun of all of a sudden this kid comes out proclaiming there are giants in the sky and what's the point of that?
The
answer is it's a cornerstone of what the story is.
It may be a cornerstone of what the musical is. And I'll grant... What we were talking about before is that, yes, I didn't quite see through to the subtext of the song, which was not the case that I did.
Rob Marshall is purposely pulling
you away from Red Song. We were talking about the same as with Red Song, which at least I was able, by the way, both what we're pointing out is that both have a sexual subtext.
Both are
them.
About getting past puberty.
Yes.
Both songs
right.
are the awareness right. of sexuality.
Right.
And in a Disney film, that can only be portrayed so far.
Well, this is the problem we were talking about. This is that the fact on that during the stage production, they had probably cast actors who were at least 18, 19
well,
years old.
Well, they have to in order to get those voices, although
right.
The two kids
were
amazing.
Great, except that when you've got an actual 12-year-old singing about her entry into womanhood, that's not going to fly as it was originally intended.
Yeah, and I believe the actress is older, but she's portraying
Portraying a 12-year-old, and she looks
or
very
she's portraying
close.
Slightly older because it is all about the beginning of
okay.
puberty.
Yeah, well, 12, 13.
12 or 13,
yeah.
That's right. Whatever the age is for a young lady.
She looks tweenish, shall we say.
Yeah, but she's on the cusp.
She may be 15 or 16 in actuality.
And the whole thing of her, you know, yeah. giving in to the wolf and all that is a metaphor for menstruation. That's what it is.
Right. Here is my problem with Jack Song, and I will acknowledge that there would have been a hard way to do it other than the way they did.
Yeah.
But what happened is that all that we see of the Giant's Kingdom, we don't see anything of the Giant's Kingdom. We see
and
Jack
by the way,
go up the
I
beanstalk.
I totally agree that Frances de La Tour deserved better.
Yes, she did.
I love her.
She did.
I'm a big
she
fan
did.
Of hers.
That's another issue that we can address. But as far as Jack Song was concerned, my problem was not specifically with Jack Song. It was with the fact that Jack Song was substituting for something we should have seen. This is a film. It's a movie.
I agree with that. Actually, I do agree with there is no reason why in the Disney universe that, no, you don't, I mean, they, well, you don't want to totally open it up because, after all, it's
yeah.
about, it's supposed to be shut
it's supposed
in,
to be about into the woods, and that's why I say that there,
but
it would have been hard to get around the way they did it,
but they needed to do something more. And they could have done it. In the point where in the show, in mm-hmm. the musical, the play,
mm-hmm.
where at the celebration of the end of Act One,
yeah.
Ever After, and all that, yeah. and the giant comes down, that we could have seen.
Yeah.
We could have seen a bit of the castle,
right.
the giant leaving the
yes.
castle, descending the beanstalk.
Yes.
There is no reason on earth a little CGI couldn't have been applied
that's
because
correct.
We're already out of the woods.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. We didn't need...
And we could have seen Frances
de La Tour. We didn't necessarily need to see the entire narrative that Jack sings about, but we needed to see something, and if it was just even... My thought was Jack... getting to the top of the beanstalk, standing in front of a CG castle and going, whoa.
Yeah.
That witch is a real witch. Yeah.
The magic is real in the story.
Yes.
We certainly get to see a whole lot
yeah.
of the witch. My only problem with the casting there, I thought that Streep did a great job,
mm-hmm.
and she does a fine job being restored, but she's supposed
yeah.
to be a little bit more than restored. She's supposed to turn into a hot item. And with all due respect, it's hard
She was hot enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Grant her that.
She did a very good role, and I've seen people on Broadway do that role
mm-hmm.
not as well
yeah.
as Streep did.
Yeah.
But for me, it will always be Bernadette Peters.
Well, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Because it's Bernadette Peters.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and because there was a law that Bernadette Peters had to be in every musical.
Well, as you know, it is not an accident and is absolutely true that Sondheim wrote it for her.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? That's known. Sunday in the Park with George. I just watched that mm-hmm. with the audio commentary, mm-hmm. which is nothing but Sondheim and Potemkin,
yeah.
although Bernadette Peters and James
yeah.
Pine are in the room. These two are talking. And Sondheim explains that he had only written very little pastiches and parts of the show, but the moment that he knew who was going to be in the show, then the show wrote itself. Mm. It literally, that's not to say that other people can't reinterpret it. He pointed out Hamlet was written for a very specific actor. Mm-hmm. And had it not been for that actor, the show would have been written very differently. And yet, look at all the great Hamlets that have been through the years. So
Streep is fine. Let's address the other issue with the giant, which was my other big problem with the film.
And this one I may well agree with.
Okay. My problem with it is that the only time you see the giant, she is some way or other obscured.
Yeah, you don't see her.
She is covered in bright. You barely see her.
There's like less than one split second where you can go, that's Frances DeLuxe.
Right. Towards the very end, right around the point where she actually expires.
Yes.
They drop out of the soft focus and the obscuring branches and all of that.
And why?
That's the point, is why are they doing that?
On stage, she was pre-recorded by, I think, Judi Dench.
And that's where I think this follows, is that, and this is sort of Rob Marshall's shortfalling, and granted, he doesn't succumb to it too much in this film, is that I think he sort of spins off of what was in the stage production and just nudges it a little further along.
The screenplay is by the guy who wrote the stage production,
but
who wrote the book.
A director should have been able to say, we can do more with this. We can actually see the giantess.
And James Lapine, by the way, as a director, as far as I'm concerned, has only really turned out one really good film. And that's not Life with Mikey. Oh, that's fine. which isn't the worst film, but it's the It's Bernadette Peters and who is playing George Sand, lusting after Chopin. And it's another variant on Bergman's Smiles of a Summer Night with a Weekend in the Country.
Hold on one second.
Starts with an I. It's one word.
Searching. Passion.
Sondheim.
Impromptu?
That's it.
Impromptu. I've never seen it.
That's a fun movie.
Yeah.
That all goes into the Smiles of a Summer Night category, along with Midsummer Sex Comedy, and, of course, Smiles of a Summer Night, and, of course, any version of Little Night Music. I've still never seen the film with that. And I'm told I'm lucky.
I haven't seen it either.
You want to stay a Diana Rigg fan? Don't watch that movie, I've been told.
The thing about the giantess is that, as we've mentioned, in the stage play, the giant is off stage. And completely. You just hear the voice.
Yeah, at one line.
Right. And whereas
because the song also There Are Giants in the Sky is more about her about him.
He's
a bad un. He goes off and he would do terrible things to you, but she will pull Jack up and draw him to her giant breasts and all
which
that.
Which Jack obsesses about.
Yes, it's
quite
very
a bit.
The book of the show, as people who've listened to Hour of the Wolf for many years, because I've always obsessed about this show, is largely based on Bruno Bettelheim's The Uses of Enchantment. Mm-hmm. And, oh my God, is it Freudian? It's Freudian in the worst possible way. It's also fascinating and very good. It provides a lot of thought. But it is that is a primary source for Into the Woods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you say we're not that far off.
We're not that far off.
I thought it was a good film.
Let me tell you something.
Was
gratuitous, and I thought that there should have been more of
it. It wasn't the song that I felt was gratuitous. It's that I felt that the song was covering up for something they should have done filmically.
No, they should have done both.
Yeah,
that's my
I would agree with that.
Is that no? Their Giants in the Sky is covering up for nothing. It's essential. However, I totally agree with you. We see more of the giantess in the play, where her head falls into the forest, and we see her head. or a portion of it anyway. Mm-hmm. We see more of her in the darned play, the huge cardboard cutout.
Yeah. And there was no reason for them to do that.
And why cast Terry Gilliam, who's wonderful?
Yeah. Terry Gilliam had a fraction of the budget for this film for Time Bandits. And he was able to pull off a giant effect with no
sound
obscuring
effects.
Visuals, with no...
Forced perception?
Forced perspective. Yeah, it was
camera,
a forced perspective.
Good actors, great sound effects.
Right, and it worked.
And shaking the camera.
Right. And that's all you needed. They did.
But I'm also a huge Time Bandits and Baron Munchausen are two of Gilliam's best films.
I would go for Brazil.
For one reason, because Tom Stoppard wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Gilliam does very well by it, but then he mucks with the end so much that you don't even know it was the end reality or was it a film. Brazil is brilliant in so many ways, but people are always going, Terry Gilliam, what great genius. Yes, absolutely. No argument there. But the thing that makes that film what that film is Tom Stoppard.
Oh, I would say it may be Tom Stoppard, but without Gilliam, it wouldn't have been.
Yeah, it's a collaboration, but it's a great screenplay. Yeah. And some of Gilliam's work has occasionally lacked great screenplays. Yeah.
Including the more recent film.
Especially, the Dr. Parnassus.
The one following it. I did the review, actually, this past year.
That's right, you did.
And I
have not yet seen it.
And it's made such an indelible impression that I can't even remember the title of the freaking thing.
I can look it up, because I actually brought all of your reviews with me. I did. I have them all on this little stick here.
Let's see who can get to it first. We're consulting our machines, people.
Yeah. I'm looking in the wrong. Kingston.
Good Lord. Zero Theorem.
That's it.
There you go.
Which actually sounds, I don't know why it hasn't made its way to video yet.
It had sort of an odd release pattern to begin with, so...
To either HBO No, I mean, I was telling people, hey, have you seen the new science fiction movie by Terry Gilliam? And people going, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And quite frankly, seeing the film, there's a good reason why. It just sort of...
Well, Dr. Parnassus, yes, I understand that Heath Ledger died, but there is it's ruined in the last 5 minutes.
I sort of dropped out of it halfway through.
It ran a little long because
Gilliam does run hot and cold for me.
But
sometimes he works, sometimes he doesn't.
There are a lot of bad reviews and people who just don't like Munchausen, which I appreciated even more after I had seen the version, the earlier version made by Goebbels.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a 1943 German...
That isn't the one.
Baron,
that isn't the hybrid animated.
No, there's no animation.
No, okay, because there is one.
That's by the Czech.
Yeah,
director.
Yeah,
who made one of my favorite movies of all time, The Fabulous World of Jules Verne.
Yeah, same style, same technology.
Very iconoclastic. Meshing of woodcuts,
yes,
and live action, and brilliant stuff.
Nice.
And it's
done.
Available on YouTube in Czech.
So brush up on your Czech.
Yeah, it's still worth, if only my mother were alive.
there you go.
But eventually they'll get around to adding that on auto-translation on YouTube because they do that kind of stuff. But
nowadays, yeah, I think it is in the public domain now, both
not
of those
sure about
films.
That. Yeah. Not sure about that. And not everything on YouTube is in the public domain.
Well, yeah, that's true, too.
The Fabulous World of Jules Verne, I believe, is in... No, it's copyrighted.
Is it?
It
yeah.
is copyrighted. Okay. But as worth seeing as The King and the Mockingbird...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which you reviewed earlier this year, which I saw under similar bad circumstances, which was the curse of that movie.
Yeah, it was. What surprised me was I watched the Peter Ustinov version, which
right.
is the fantastic... I think it's the Fantastic
Ustinov.
Adventure.
I don't know why everybody's always Ustinov. He said Ustinov.
I'll go with it, Ustinov.
Yeah, it's easy.
I don't care. I'm easy.
Yeah.
I actually saw the Peter Ustinov version, The Fantastic Adventures of Mr. Wonderbird, I think, is the title. And what's interesting is actually how faithful they were. There's a lot that's missing from Wonderbird that is in The King and the Mockingbird.
Mm.
But what's in Wonderbird in terms of what they do with the translation is pretty faithful to what eventually wound up in Mr. Wonderbird. It wasn't like one of those dubbed Japanese feature films where, mm-hmm. you know, where Budo all of a sudden turns into Big Belly Daddy, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So you can actually, and I sort of hesitate saying it because I would prefer people actually see The King and the Mockingbird, which is the nicer version, and also...
Well, I'm sure now that it's been restored, yeah. I'm sure that that will be available shortly.
Well, certainly it is. I mean, that was the whole idea of this American release now, is that finally it's getting into America.
Yeah, well, first it was in theaters, but I'm sure it'll be on streaming or cable.
Yeah.
I think more likely straight to Netflix kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or Amazon Prime.
And I would say it's worth waiting to see that version instead of going out to YouTube.
Yeah, people can see the trailer on YouTube for sure and get an idea of the glory and the bizarreness, especially the robot in the middle of this sort of Hans Christian Andersen style story.
Right. Which people seem to be relating that to Japanese animation. What strikes me is that it actually resembles the robot from Superman and the robots from the Fleischers. And I suspect that a lot of King and the Mockingbird,
and
it's a lot of inspiration.
What year was that originally?
King and the Mockingbird, it was... They started it, I think... in 1948, the unofficial...
So it totally predates anime.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. No, sorry, gang.
Yeah.
It's not ripping from anime.
No, not at all. Not at all. And the robot is in the original version as
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, nice try. But, I think you're right about it's echoing the Fleischer's Superman.
Yeah.
The Fleischer robot, as it were. So you promised on Twitter and other places a 10 best list of genre films. I didn't bring any such list with me. I haven't prepared because I have been working. Mm-hmm. And when I get back home this morning, I'll be working.
I wanted to go. I wanted to go through this. This is sort of a it's somewhat rough, you know. It's one of those things where on a different day I do it in somewhat of a different order, but this is pretty much the way.
Yeah, I mean, some critics, they don't bother giving the order. They say these films are in my top 10.
Yeah, but actually, yeah. And some do
top 15.
This is the rough order of the way I'm looking at the films that I saw.
Today, yes.
This year. It wasn't a bad year.
It was sort of an
average year. It's not like, let me put it this way. Last year, 2013 could have been the year prior, 2013, could have been summed up with one word, gravity, which sort of bumped the curve up all over the place.
Although I, of course, had
issues. I know.
No, I don't take issues with Gravity.
Yeah.
I just include the opposite end of the spectrum. Gravity, which is actual bona fide fiction based on science, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a good way to put it.
Yeah.
The other end going into pure spec fic, but still fulfilling the regimen of science fiction, Her.
Okay.
I can see that.
I
still see as one of the best science fiction films. Didn't even get a bleeping Hugo nomination.
You know me. Her wouldn't have made... Her actually did not make my list.
I'm aware of that.
Last year. It just didn't work
for me. Without giving a number one or two or three, it's in my top five.
Right. By the way, you want to know my worst film for 2014? Okay. Won't be Transformers because I did not see that. But I sort of suspect that Transformers wouldn't have made it anyway because for me, the Transformers films are just sort of boring and pointless. They don't really reach the level. They're also not made for you and I.
They're made for 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
Although so is Doctor Who, and yet.
Yeah, still. And it isn't, although this almost made it, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which was a bad film, except that there was a level of competency to it, and actually the sequence where Spider-Man confronts Electro in Times Square, I actually thought was a pretty good sequence.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have not seen any of the amazing Spider-Man.
You haven't missed anything.
And I'm aware of that. I didn't even bother with Sam Raimi's third Spider-Man. I really enjoyed the first one.
Right.
I was sort of like, for the second one. So no need to see the third.
My actual worst film for 2014...
Genre film,
is Vampire Academy.
Okay,
which was the Weinsteins' attempt to get into the female teen adolescent market and pretty much came off like a concatenation of Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, and... Twilight.
Vampire Diaries. Twilight.
Yeah. And it was just...
I'll bet you anything it made money.
Oh, I haven't heard
so
that...
So it's a successful film, isn't it? Their point of view.
They haven't announced a sequel. If it had actually been successful, the sequel would have been on its way. So I don't think it was that much of a success.
Yeah, good point, yes. The franchise failed.
Yeah, the franchise failed. Thank goodness it was an incompetent film. There was one sequence in it where all the characters are running through this courtyard at night, and they run through the courtyard, and they exit the courtyard into the courtyard again.
Okay.
You know, it was just that type of film. So Vampire Academy was my worst. As far as the good films.
Okay,
we're starting from
drum
the bottom.
Roll, please.
Okay. This one,
do you consider Into the Woods genre? You did. You reviewed it.
Yeah, that's true. Into the Woods, I consider genre. Wouldn't have made my list. It really didn't cross my mind that it was 2014 because actually I saw it in 2015.
But it was released Christmas Day.
It's a very good film. It wouldn't have made this list. I stick with the list that I've got.
Okay.
So number 10, and this is something that people may have forgotten about, Noah.
Okay.
The Darren Aronofsky film.
The only reason they've forgotten about it is that for some bizarre reason, it hasn't made the... has it made the HBO Netflix...
No, not yet.
It's available for, quote, purchase on streaming.
Probably
like,
on Amazon.
$16.
Yeah. But it hasn't made Netflix yet. It was sort of, I think, early
or HBO for
in
that
the
matter.
Year.
It hasn't...
It was very good. Darren Aronofsky doesn't usually do like mainstream.
No, this is the first time he's ever done anything with money.
Yeah, That's true. That's true. And he actually did very well. And what was interesting was that it's essentially two films. It's the first two-thirds is the mainstream commercial adventure, and it's got the special effects and the stop-motion creatures. There's some nice stuff that sort of harkens back to Harryhausen, and it's got the comic relief in it. And then the second half of the film, and I suspect that entire first part of the film served as his excuse to get the money to do the second part of the film, which was a confrontation and sort of an inquest into the meaning of faith, what it means to be blindly faithful to something, and the consequences of that. And so the thing is that there was substance to that second part, and there was also, and this is sort of a knock to it, he still had to feed the beast, so he included a character in the second part of the film, pretty much just so that he could have a fist fight at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still depth and meaning to it, and it was a good, entertaining film.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't remember the details, but there was a very good article in The New Yorker
mm-hmm.
about an interview with Aronofsky about how he didn't want to do the movie because of the money attached to it. Mm-hmm. And all that, and it's just not the way he wants to make movies, and why he took it on, and how he took it on, and what his relationship to dealing with, now you have all that money, and you've got to use it.
And,
which is not the way he wants to make movies. I'm not the world's biggest Darren Aronofsky fan, but boy, do I respect his...
I run hot and cold on him as well. He's done some very good stuff. I actually had problems with Black Swan. Just did not work for me. But
as you say that, we get a Facebook message or a text saying Black Swan was the first big money film Aronofsky did. And that's true. It's big money, but it's not big CGI. But yes, Bobson, you are quite correct.
I think in this particular case, in the case of Noah, he handled the money very well. He came up with an entertaining film. And possibly he should consider doing more big money films.
Maybe so.
You know, I would like to see him do more. Number 9. Okay, this is another one that probably slipped through a lot of nets. Coherence.
Yeah.
Very That's small film.
That certainly totally slipped through mine,
Beautifully done. This was done by James Ward Burkett, who wrote and directed. He was also the writer on Rango, and it's about a group of friends in Southern California who get together for a lovely little dinner party on the night that a meteor passes over and essentially opens up a transdimensional portal near their house. And it was a beautiful playing out of the scientific idea of infinite dimensions and infinite realities. I suspect that in some ways Burkett sort of cheated by throwing in a sort of randomizing element so that you couldn't really track back to see how all the realities played against each other. But it was nicely observed. He's got a nice little observation of the L.A. ecology and the L.A. socializing, particularly among a certain breed of Southern Californian professionals. Mm-hmm. And It gets very dark towards the end, and yet for all the darkness, it's still in an odd way touching.
Mm.
So it was a very nice, very...
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I really did like Rango, although I felt, but this is true mm-hmm. of almost every movie I've ever seen, give me a razor blade or a digital razor blade, I could have cut 20 minutes from it.
Yeah.
But that's not the fault of the director. Yeah. That's the fault of the studios that don't believe in the double feature, that everything's got to be approached. You know, if it's animated, it's 90 minutes. If it's not animated, it's 2 hours.
Yeah.
If it's Christopher Nolan,
Rango was
it's
good.
4 hours.
Rango is good. Coherence is very nice.
Mm.
Coherence is very nice. Number 8, and this will probably provoke some screams, Godzilla.
Now, I haven't seen it, so I do know that
there were a lot of complaints about the fact that the monster doesn't, you don't get a good look at the monster until the end of the film. But that's only if you don't understand sort of the Godzilla genre to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, you don't show the monster.
Exactly.
Ever. Until near the end.
Yeah, until the payoff.
Even Cloverfield, a movie that
strictly speaking,
the hell out of
for me. All that this is supposed to be reintroducing the monster, and in particular reintroducing the monster to Western audiences,
right.
It still takes the format of one of the Godzilla sequels. This could slot in to one of the line of Godzilla films that they introduced
so
in Japan.
So slightly schizophrenic in that sense.
Yeah, in that way.
Serving too many masters.
But what the director Gareth Edwards does here is that he focuses more on the human drama to start, and he gives you the monsters as a payoff. And it actually worked very well. And his envisioning of the monsters and the choreographing of the battles was actually very good. Mm-hmm. So that's Godzilla there. And for number seven, another blast from the past brought to the present, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Which I have still not seen. I have to say I really admired. Wait, is that the first one?
This is the second one. This is the one that was released.
Yeah, a lot of people liked that.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, I was shocked. I really liked, despite James Franco, and Lithgow was very good.
Lithgow was good. You should know. I defer to you.
He's a former WBA staff member. And I have the only time I've ever performed on stage, it was with him. Mm-hmm. I've performed on stage with John Lithgow. Six other people as well, but There are photos.
As far as Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is concerned, it's incredible that what they did was take a franchise that, even from the start, was rather campy and silly. Not so much at the beginning.
I'm sorry. The Rod Serling version, 1969, 67?
I believe 69.
Yeah,
69,
I mean,
because it followed 2001.
It's pre-1970.
Yeah.
And it has turned into camp, as has Romeo and Juliet, as have so many things that, you know, what was it doing that had been
eventually
done before?
Well, let's put it this way.
It reeks of its era.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
It reeks of its era. It's got an iconoclastic person that we love to throw pies at in the lead.
Let me put it this way. Let me rephrase that the Rod Serling original, at the very least, at points, had its tongue firmly planted in its cheek.
Oh, as any Rod Serling.
Yes.
Well, not every.
In this particular case, that. But they took that, and eventually it did devolve into camp, and they've made it a legitimate drama. They've done something very interesting. This was not so much with the previous film, which was Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Right.
But with this film, the narrative weight shifts more towards the apes than the human beings. So essentially, the film is done from the viewpoint of the apes, to the point where while the humans have
Turning it into one big circus.
There's a pun there, Andy. I had to tell that listener sitting over to the left.
There.
Okay, that's fine. Glad all you folks got it.
It's S-E-R-K-I-S. Anyway.
Yes. While the humans are still present there and they carry their weight of the drama, they actually sort of all sort of meld into like one bland character. There really isn't that much that distinguishes the humans in this film. It's a story really about the apes. There seems to be, at least when the film came out, there seemed to be an attempt there to position Andy Serkis for a best actor
Oscar. Which he should have gotten years ago.
He should have gotten, he will never get, and will never get unless they initiate a new award for best motion capture performance. Because I don't think regular actors are going to let
people don't
the motion
get that.
Capture.
They think it's just animation.
Yeah.
And
they don't understand.
I had a conversation with somebody whom I'm saying Andy Serkis definitely deserved for for the Two Towers.
You can go onto the web, and I'm not sure it's on YouTube, but you can see split screen videos of the actual footage from the Planet of the Apes film. Mm. And the actual performance capture of Andy Serkis, he is delivering a genuine performance.
As he did
there.
Earlier. He is an actor in a pioneering technology.
Yeah.
But the point is that, yes, it's a performance. Without him in there, or mm-hmm. another actor of equal quality, without him in there, it would not have worked. I mean, King Kong, whatever. But
King Kong, other problems with King Kong.
Yes, like it being
18 hours long.
It's a Peter Jackson film.
Yeah, yeah.
Bloat is the middle name.
Let me go to number six.
Yes.
X-Men Days of Future Past.
I really enjoyed that. Not just because I had Chris Claremont here.
It's a very good film. You know, basically, I would like to think that Fox sort of looked at what happened with X-Men First Class and the various Wolverine spinoffs and said, boy, we really blanked the pooch.
Yeah, well,
they brought
back Bryan Singer.
And they brought back Bryan Singer.
Very Singer. It's very simple. Is it a good X-Men movie? Answer, did Bryan Singer direct it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. You know, they basically, when they did First Class, basically people were, you know, looking at roles, you know, where Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen were playing it, and then all of a sudden here's James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender, and everybody went, meh.
I had issues.
So, you know, basically, this should have been the film that preceded First Class. This should have been the bridge film that would have given us both the classic actors in the role.
And it is because
and introduced.
They're taking the franchise from this film, from Days of Future Past,
right.
Not from First Class.
Yeah.
Because, supposedly the next film, and also they're just taking a look at who the stars are.
Yeah.
So it's Mystique / Magneto.
Yeah. Yeah, basically they've rewritten the timeline now.
What they've done is they said, we've got Jennifer Lawrence here.
Yeah.
We've got Michael Fassbender here. You know, that screen is scorching, and we've got Jennifer Lawrence in pasties and Michael Fassbender in weird cosplay.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
yeah. Yeah, no. They basically rewrote the timeline because they realized they messed up.
Yeah, but also, I mean, they didn't just rewrite the timeline because the comic already did that.
Well, yeah.
The Chris Claremont was two issues.
Yeah.
Of course, the difference is that it was Rogue.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who goes back in time, not Wolverine. Yeah. But you see, they pointed out very simply because there was a difference in the year between the comic. In the comic, she goes back to the 70s. In the movie, she didn't live. She wasn't alive during the 70s, so they had to make it another character. And, hey, Hugh Jackman still looks good at age 50.
and by the way, as I noted in my review, one of the things that I thought was brilliant about this was taking the X-Men and the whole notion of the mutants and the paranoia that engenders it and taking it directly into the Nixon White House.
Yeah. Yeah, that was clever. But of course, that whole paranoia thing, pardon me, that's been the theme.
Yeah, well, yeah. But
since Chris Claremont took the series over from Stan Lee.
Yeah. Okay, so Number five?
Yeah.
Interstellar.
Now, you see, I'm not even that interested in seeing that film. I will really? Eventually.
You should see it at
I
the
will
very
least
because it does
And
pay
I'm sorry
homage.
That I'll see it on the small screen because I understand some of the visuals are fabulous.
You really need...
But I don't know that...
You should go to see... Here again...
You and I agree on one thing. That the best science fiction movie ever made, period, bar none, no argument... Tune out if you don't like this statement, is 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Correct.
And this is one of several films, a small handful of films, that says, I love that film and I am going to give a response to it.
Yeah.
The other one is Tarkovsky's Solaris, which is an absolute response to 2001 is an angry response, but it's a response. This one is a more loving response.
More loving response. I think
But I've yet to see a Christopher Nolan movie that I like from beginning to end.
Well, then you probably won't like this one much anyway. I'll be honest about that. But you know
And
what?
I know all the spoilers. I know the whole thing.
One thing is that I appreciated that he respected 2001, that he was paying homage.
Oh, he's a brilliant movie maker.
He's a brilliant movie maker. And what I thought was great about this film was that it took a scientific concept and was able to tell an emotionally valid story to
it. I like Contact, too, but...
this is better than Contact.
And I liked Contact.
Yeah.
I mean, it had issues when, you know, they had to have a Matthew McConaughey character in there in order to validate, oh, yes, but, you know, science and religion aren't actually at war with each other. And actually, I would actually agree with that statement, but Sagan was really just doing the hard sell on that.
Yeah.
And I didn't care for that, and the movie maintained that hard sell.
And I had that problem with Contact,
and I believe I will have a similar problem with Interstellar.
Similar to Contact, I will say this, similar to Contact, the final act is a problem. The final act was a problem for me, too.
Well, you see, that, in fact, sums up several Chris Nolan movies for me. Start with The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
The Joker is dead. End the freaking film.
The Joker doesn't die.
Joker is off, out of the story.
Joker is out of the,
End the movie.
Yeah.
That's it. We don't need Two-Face. We don't need that thing. Mm. Is that important to the next film? Fine. Make it a prelude to the next film. Here's an even better idea. Make it a short subject. Make it a make it a cable-only kind of thing.
I would say they don't do that, but occasionally now they do do
yes,
that.
Yes, they absolutely do that. It's the DVD extra.
Yeah.
They do it with Doctor Who
DVD extra
the
or the quote-unquote webisode.
Yeah, exactly. Do something like that will you know, sneak in the 20-minute movie as the prologue to Inception.
Mm-hmm.
People walk in for Inception, another long movie that could have been cut 40 minutes shorter, and bang, there's this episode in there, and that would have worked perfectly. But the movie, the Dark Knight ends 2 hours in, and it's a 2-hour, 40-minute movie, and it just runs too long. Dark Knight Rises works better, except for the third act works better, but you again could have cut 40 minutes out of that film and made it better that way.
What? Chris Nolan going, what would you rather see? Would you rather spend time with Batman or watch Bruce Wayne with his Afghani chiropractor?
Yeah.
You know, so...
Very much so. And Inception,
Rises.
The whole snow chase?
Yeah.
Really? You know, I didn't come...
No.
Here's a brilliant movie. Good science fiction. Smart.
Inception.
And then we have to go into a James Bond film for no reason whatsoever.
Well, that was the point of the film. That was the point of the film, was to go through those genres. He goes through several levels. He goes through the crime film. He goes through the Kubrick film. And then he goes to the James Bond film.
Well,
and that was the point of Inception, was for him to play with those genres.
Well, okay, you know what? Let him play with himself. don't play with me that way, because I didn't come there for that. I came for good science fiction.
Yeah.
And he had it. He had it. The folding of Paris is an amazing moment in science fiction cinema. And
beautiful visually. Along with the actual, and I forget what the levels they call it, but the level, the final bottom level, the mm-hmm. level that you're not supposed to go to, was a beautiful visualization.
But it was,
I don't think the film as a whole
isn't as original as many people think. Especially for those of us who read this stuff. But it was well conceived, well done, and then all of a sudden to go into a spoof of a spoof,
mm-hmm.
you know, cut all those spoofs shorter and give me a 110-minute movie instead of a 2-hour and 40-minute movie, and now you've got a film that just ranks brilliantly instead of this overblown, overrated conflation of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Batman trilogy, by the way, I think Batman Begins is the best of the three.
I would still hold with the Dark Knight. We're sort of running out of time, so
Lister.
Run through. Well, we may be running over. Well, so
I can't afford to do that.
Okay, so let me go with number four here, and you may have noticed that up to this point there hasn't been any animated films in this list. I'm going to make up for it now. Number four is The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, which is a film by Isao Takahata out of Studio Ghibli. Isao Takahata, as I mentioned in the review, is the guy at Studio Ghibli who isn't Miyazaki.
Or his sons.
Basically, he sort of...
Because Miyazaki isn't Miyazaki anymore either, so...
He sort of characterizes himself as, in comparison to Miyazaki, as a hedgehog. He just sort of keeps his head down and does his work. The interesting thing about him is that he tends to be, while Miyazaki is undeniably a great filmmaker, Takahata at times can be a more experimental and adventurous filmmaker. He can go, he can take a more stylized route than Miyazaki does. He does stuff like My Neighbors, The Yamadas.
I'm just waiting for some Japanese animator to use tweening. don't like the style, period.
They do use tweening. It's just that they animate on twos. It's a different, it's a more economical approach to animation, except that at this point, even when they have the money, they still do it. But
Ghibli is all the money it needs.
Yeah, let me just cover this film here, because, I mean, this was a beautiful film. It's based on an old Japanese legend about a bamboo farmer who discovers a young girl in a stalk of bamboo. They raise the child as their own and eventually raise her to be a princess. It's a beautiful, stunning film. It's done in the style of a storybook with this beautiful watercolor brushwork type art, and it, like a lot of Takahata films, it's also rather devastating towards the end, and so it was just like, in comparison to like the CG stuff that we're getting from the American studios, it's just an incredibly beautiful and moving experience. Number three. The Song, excuse me, not the, but just Song of the Sea, which is done by the Irish filmmaker. I did this review a few weeks ago.
Yeah, this one I really want to see. I can't find it anywhere.
I think it was released to theaters. It's not on video yet. Yeah. It will eventually get there because this is being done by G Kids,
and this
and they
is the
eventually...
same person who did Book of Kells.
Book of Kells,
which I loved.
Yeah, and this is an incredible follow-up to it. It's the same style. He has this wonderful sort
it's
of
about
2D,
a Silky, which is a favorite.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's about a young boy who discovers his sister is a Selkie.
Right.
And he has to get her to the sea in order to save her life.
Make a good double feature with The Secret of Rowan Inish.
Yes, exactly. It plays off the same myth. This is more family friendly. Of course.
And there's another Selkie film which I saw not that long ago.
There's a film with Colin Farrell.
Yeah, that's the one.
And it is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I can't remember the name of it. It's a very good film. It would be a plot spoiler to say actually what genre it is, but I'm going to say it anyway. It isn't actually a genre film, but it plays like a genre film, and it's very good as well.
And Local Hero isn't technically a genre film, but it belongs.
That's true, too. Let me finish off the list quick.
Yes.
Number two, The Babadook, which I still haven't seen,
and I'm going to get behind the sofa when I do.
Very worthwhile. It is the rare horror film that actually scares me.
Yeah.
These days,
everybody. I mean, A.O. Scott put it in his top 10. You know, Tony Scott, doing all cinema, put that in his top 10.
It's deserving of it. Essie Davis delivers a great performance,
as she always does.
Yeah.
Anybody who's watched Miss Vicious Mysteries or the BBC non-musical version of Sweeney Todd knows. She's a great Mrs. Lovett.
Right. What's fascinating about this film is the female perspective that the film has, and even the way the film addresses this story. You know, I can say that, you know, this is a film about a parent who comes to believe her child is a monster, except that in this particular film, the child is regarded as a monster the way parents actually experience their child being a monster, that sort of willful, irrational, inconsolable at times attitude that a young child can have where nothing can reach them and there's no way to control them.
Mm-hmm.
And watching Essie Davis go through the stages of being worn down by this, it's a fantastic performance. So,
We'll find out a lot more in about 6 hours is when the Academy nominations come out.
Is it really? I don't track it. But
yeah, Thursday the 15th.
Hopefully they will consider it.
At 6 a.m. Yeah. L.A. time.
It's really deserving. Let me get to my number one because this will blow everybody away and will provoke a lot of screaming, I am sure. Number one, Under the Skin.
Now,
this was,
I liked it. I didn't adore it.
I really fell in love with it. I love the beauty of it. I love the intelligence. I love the strangeness of it. I honestly liked the fact that it occasionally referenced 2001.
Yes.
I liked the idea that they took the old Saw of the alien falling to Earth to perform a mission and sort of turned it on its head. This is a film...
As does The Man Who Fell to Earth in its way.
Yeah.
This is the one who fell to Earth.
Yeah. This is very much of a piece with that. You do feel that you are seeing the world through an alien's eyes. One of the interesting things that Jonathan Glazer, the director, did, by the way, Scarlett Johansson is the star of this.
And she's amazing.
Yeah. One of the things that
she turned out a lot of good movies, including Lucy, which I think should have made some people's list as good science fiction film.
I did not see it. I missed it.
You have a treat in store for you. I'm one of the few who still like Luc Besson.
What Glazer did, though, was he, in order to create this atmosphere, he actually put Scarlett Johansson in a van, tricked out with cameras, and had her drive around Scotland talking to random strangers.
Yeah, do you, by the way, listeners out there, male or female, how would you like to be walking down a street and a van opens up and there's Scarlett Johansson saying, come here?
Yeah. That'll turn your world around.
That will do something to you, yes.
But really, the inversion of the old cliches and just the atmosphere and the beauty of it sort of put this at the top of my list. So that is my top 10. I did want to make a note of, do we have time? No, we don't have time.
Not really.
Never mind.
Make a very quick note.
Okay. Interesting failure, the Congress.
Yes, very interesting failure. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Stanislaw Lem fans must see it. Robin Wright fans must see it. It's very clever.
Prepare to be disappointed, though. But
ultimately, it doesn't work, but it's a great effort.
Yeah. Do you want to, because I know this sort of slotted into the category as well, Radio Free Album for you. It didn't really work for me.
It goes into the same category as the Congress for me. Altruistic, good, you know, props for trying.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, starting today, there's some kind of Philip K. Dick Film Festival in New York. Google that up. Yeah, Google that up. It's their third annual to find out more. But we have to get off the air.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Babadook. and stay tuned for Babadook, Baby Babadook with Lister.
We didn't even get to the films coming up this year.
Yeah, well, we'll do another show during... and my theme song is already over. I'll just start it again because I know Lister likes it anyway.
He wants us to stretch.
There we go. Okay, yeah. Okay, so yeah, but I mean, we have a whole other show to do here, and we haven't touched on television.
That's true, too. Well, although I will admit, I shall.
There's a lot of interesting skiffy TV.
Yeah.
I'd start.
Much of it, I'll have to admit, I missed.
Yeah. But did you see, for example, Flatline?
No.
Starring Peter Capaldi and Jenna Louise Coleman?
I did.
It's an episode of Doctor Who. How could you?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Scripted by Stephen Moffat.
Yeah.
No. Not scripted by Stephen Moffat. Different writer. New writer.
Yeah.
But I mean, some of Doctor Who this year was superb.
I would say just in general, the new Capaldi Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Big improvement over what we were getting before, and I think if it's Flatline, if that's the one you're talking
about.
With
the creatures, the two-dimensional creatures.
Yeah. I think, yes, that's it. That's the one, which is...
Very clever, very well done,
among the classic Who episodes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was written to be a classic.
Yeah.
So what we will do is during the thon, which begins in February.
Okay.
We'll do this again. Yes.
Yeah. And it won't be too late.
I've got a great idea for a premium. We'll discuss it.
Okay.
Listeners will find out at that time. So again, thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Check us out on Facebook. Visit OurWolf.com. My email is jim@OurWolf.com. And all good stuff like that there. Again, stay tuned for Lister, and I'll be back next week about 1:30 a.m. with I don't know what yet, but tune in anyway. I will. Good morning, and be good to each other.
pressure, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledged allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing, the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm pissy attacked. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes, cause the real meaning is what the message must. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torched the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Cinco, list alive, WBAI, 99 single is still alive right here. The show is called Burn Baby Burn, and you know what we do best? We burn imperialist red, white, and blue to ashes with no apology. Yeah. Je suis Charlie. 99 single. WBAI. Until 5 o'clock, burn baby burn.